The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated November 22/November 29, 2021, although I am recording this on December 20th to be heard by you December 22nd and thereafter. It's titled in bright white, Best Inventions of 2021, below which are the large Time lettering, T-I-M-E letters, in white, a dull white, and it's bordered as usual in red with a small white interior margin. Various things are pictured on the cover: a more accurate world map, a smarter slip-on running shoe, a toy that keeps kids calm, and a mini car that teaches coding, among others, because it does mention best inventions of 2021. The first article that I shall read is entitled Six Questions. It's written by Andrew R. Chow, Robert Plant, and Alison Krauss, the Led Zeppelin frontman and the bluegrass icon, on their new album, Transcending Genre Bounds and TikTok. Andrew R. Chow writes this article, and there's a photo of the two principals on the bottom. It's in black and white, and only portions of them are shown, with Alison Krauss dressed in black, wearing earrings with long, flowing, blondish hair, and next to her, Robert Plant, distinguished-looking, in a black suit and black open-collared shirt, long, shoulder length, just about as long as Alison Krauss's graying hair, with a smartly trimmed mustache and beard, looking rather somberly, almost grimly, with some facial wrinkles into the camera. The question then, on your new collaborative record, Raise the Roof, you cover musicians like Geechee Wiley and the Everly Brothers. Are there qualities in older roots and country songs that are missing from current pop? Alison Krauss, A.K. I like the simplicity and the timelessness of the songs on this record and from that era. There's no current phrases or anything, and the way they phrased things was so beautiful. There's a romance about their poetry. Question, while both of you move freely between genre, there have been many debates lately over what it is and isn't, over what is and isn't country music, especially related to Lil Nas X and Casey Musgraves. What do you make of those tensions? Robert Plant, RP. Are there genres just for charts, or just so the industry, whatever that term is, can decide who does what or where it fits? I know, we've been in it. When Raising Sand had its ultimate zenith moment in the sun, what category were we in? I don't know. A.K., it's funny, the industry, they want you to be unique and different, and then they're mad they can't put you in a category. R.P., I think it's absolute rubbish. If you go to the glorious days of the late 60s, I don't know whether there were Grammys then, I suppose there were. Where did that leave people like Jefferson Airplane and stuff? Are they rock? No. What is going on? Question. Led Zeppelin had just joined TikTok, and videos tagged with Allison's name on the app have 5 million views. Are you excited about the app's impact on music? RP. I don't want to sound like some tired old fart, some hippie languishing in the afterglow, but when we make these records, it's a collection of songs. It'll come as a bit of a surprise to some people who can't even imagine that an artist would want to start at track 1 and finish track 12 and say, this is where we're at. But what did you say at the beginning? Led Zeppelin what? Question. Led Zeppelin has an official TikTok account. RP. Well, thanks for telling me. Question, you two won Best Album at the Grammys in 2009. Do you have any Grammy aspirations this time? RP, what category? Comedy, maybe? I don't know. We never thought that we'd ever make a record together. If you think about us in isolation 15 years ago, you'd never imagine we could get to this point. I mean, she's such a nice woman to end up singing alongside a monster. AK, we made something we're all proud of. Just a really nice, enjoyable, inspired time. RP, it's been a frolic. It's a shame it's fall and winter, because otherwise we could be skipping along the side of that river that winds through Tennessee. I've been canoeing there. AK, the Harpeth. RP, yeah, the Harpeth, skipping on the riverbank with flowers in our hair. Daisy dancing. But the Grammys? I don't know about that. I'll have to buy some new clothes. Robert, this is the question. Robert, did you see that the singer-songwriter Margot Price dressed up as you for Halloween? RP, no, how about that? Which me was it? Question, at Kezar Stadium in San Francisco in 1973, holding a dove. RP, that old chestnut, I also had a cigarette and a bottle of Newcastle Brown, and none of that was staged. I have to say, very, very strange moment. I once had a girlfriend who said that I had a kind of low hum that attracted animals and small children. Well, thank you, Margot, wherever you are. I hope she looked as good as I did then. Moving now to the politics heading, Doug Day, D-O-U-G, space day afternoon, a trip with the first, second gentleman, by Charlotte Alter. There are some folks standing around in the sun on the green grass while a gentleman in gray slacks and a plaid gray and maroon or wine-colored plaid jacket with a blue and white striped shirt, brown shoes, is standing one-footed on a purple mat on the green grass. He has his hands clasped in front of him. He's smiling at the camera behind shades, that is, brownish-colored sunglasses. He has short graying hair. We'll see if that is Doug, the second gentleman. It is. It's Imhoff practicing his tree pose with a yoga class during a trip to New Jersey, October 19. Photographs for this article are by Landon Nordeman for Time, and the article is written by Charlotte Alter. It is a sunny October day, and Doug Imhoff is back in his native New Jersey for the first time as second gentleman of the United States. It looks surprisingly the same, except this beautiful city walk we're on, which is incredible, he says, gesturing to a riverside pathway, which sits across from a set of dumpsters, a pile of old mattresses, and an ambulance parking lot. It really feels like home. Imhoff, that's E-M-H-O-F-F. Just finished a long day of asking people how it's going. First, he was at a Newark high school asking students, how's it going? Going back to school. He told the principal that they've got it going on with their high school student vaccination rate. Then after eating lunch at a picnic table outside a diner, he had come to this scenic path in Elizabeth to visit young environmental cleanup workers and talk about the climate provisions of President Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan. Imhoff walks abnormally slowly, his hands clasped at his belt, pretending to ignore the photographers crouching ahead of him. Occasionally, he looks down at a rectangular note card and says something like, "What does a space like this do for your community and your peers?" If all this seems a little new to him, Imhoff deserves a bit of slack. Not long ago, he was a single dad, an L.A. lawyer, perhaps best known for winning an intellectual property case involving the Taco Bell Chihuahua. Today, the husband of Vice President Kamala Harris, he actually refers to her as Kamala Harris when she's not around, is the first ever male spouse of a vice president and the first Jewish person in one of the two leading couples of American life. Imhoff has turned out to be pretty good at this unlikely role. He is one of the White House's most enthusiastic surrogates, traveling to 30 states and 21 COVID-19 vaccine clinics to promote Biden and Harris's domestic policy agenda and vaccination push. Party fundraising emails sent out under Imhoff's name do as well as those signed by high-profile congressional Democrats, according to a party spokesperson. And Imhoff was one of the party's top five email fundraisers in September. I wanted to know what it was like for a regular guy to suddenly become one quarter of America's most powerful double date. Few people get to inhabit the all-encompassing political machinery that surrounds the president and vice president. Fewer still experience it with fresh eyes, unjaded by decades of guarded politicking. In the span of just over a year, Imhoff's been thrust into an uneasy world of constant scrutiny and heightened security. He never used the word lonely, but I think there's so much stuff that he cannot do, says one old friend. Does Imhoff ever stop to wonder how a guy who's trying to get his wife to like Radiohead and named his fantasy football team Nirvana became someone who's surrounded by earpieced bodyguards and gets birthday gifts from the President of the United States? He smiles, blinks slowly, and says in a low voice, "Every minute of every day." Imhoff works from a corner office at the end of a gleaming hallway in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building next to the White House, overlooking the Washington Monument. It is crammed with knickknacks, a photo of his first flight on Air Force Two, a map with pins for every place he's visited as second gentleman, a souvenir from star quarterback Tom Brady's visit to the White House. "Everyone wanted to talk about football, so I asked him about golf," Imhoff recalls. "And at the end, I said, 'Who are you again?'" Born in Brooklyn in 1964 and raised in Old Bridge, New Jersey, Imhoff moved as a teenager to California, where he attended college and law school. As a corporate lawyer at Venable LLP in Los Angeles, he represented clients like the pharmaceutical company Merck and the arms dealer DeLorean Capital, as well as the husband of one of the Real Housewives. Former colleagues recall him as competitive where it mattered, but with a reputation for looking out for younger associates. One junior colleague recalled Imhoff would be the partner who ordered Chipotle for associates working long nights at the office. Imhoff is a good sit-next-to guy, says his close friend Mitch Evall. He's a really pointed observer of human behavior, so Imhoff is referred to as a good sit-next-to guy. "Everyone I called told me the same thing," Imhoff seems to be, as NBC Universal CEO Jeff Shell put it, "just a good dude." Imhoff's son Cole described him as a little embarrassing and mentioned his habit of falling asleep in movies. Cole and his sister Ella used to tease Imhoff for forcing them down Black Diamond slopes on family ski trips in what they called Evil Daddy Ski School. He called them Cole and Ella after jazz greats. They call him Doug, not Dad. Cole says his friends like to rib him about the Democratic fundraising appeals they receive under his father's name. "Oh, your dad just emailed me." Imhoff met Harris in 2013 on a blind date set up by a mutual friend. He was immediately smitten. Even now, friends say Imhoff's so excited to see the vice president when she comes home that he will hang up on them in the middle of a FaceTime conversation. He'll be like, "She's home," says Evall, and it's a blank screen. When the couple met, Harris was the Attorney General of California, a big job, but not one that required Imhoff to upend his life. Even when Harris won a U.S. Senate seat in 2016, the move to D.C. did not change much. Imhoff joined the law firm DLA Piper, but he was still an anonymous figure who could go to the grocery store, attend Dodgers games, and live a relatively normal life. Imhoff and his ex-wife Kirsten Imhoff have been close friends friends and co-parents since their 2009 divorce. He remained her lawyer and business advisor till he gave up his law practice before the inauguration in January. By all accounts, theirs is a thoroughly harmonious, blended family. Still, Emhoff has grown since his first marriage. He now tries to listen more than you talk, he says. And Kirsten says he does things with Harris, like planned couple trips that he didn't before. Of course he's a better husband, and that's great, Kirsten says. That's how it should be. Kirsten says Emhoff was always supportive of her career during their marriage, but being the spouse of a presidential candidate requires a different level of cheerleading. During Harris's short-lived run, Emhoff was rarely without a T-shirt bearing his wife's name. Former campaign staff recall he tended to be more digitally savvy than some of Harris's advisors, often the first to see a particular Instagram post or tweet about the campaign. Once glued to Instagram, Emhoff now has the phone of a 7-year-old, he says, for security reasons. His apparent glee at his wife's accomplishments made him America's favorite wife guy, partly because he seemed less closed off than other political spouses. In politics, you're expected to be very guarded, recalls Chasten Buttigieg, who became friends with Emhoff during the Democratic presidential primary. But he would see me down the hallway and he would shout my name across hundreds of people. When Biden chose Harris as his running mate in August 2020, life changed on a dime, without any time to breathe or reflect, Emhoff recalls. Reporters were suddenly camped outside his condo, his living room filled with campaign staff toting boxes of binders. It was just like a rocket ship. Emhoff was thrust on stage into a carefully choreographed ballet of official duties, even though he is still learning the steps. At Biden's inauguration, for example, Emhoff briefly went viral for forgetting where to stand as he and Harris climbed the stairs of the Capitol. They're trying to explain to you, okay, you're going to get out of the limo and walk up the stairs in this order. I'm like, okay, I got it, he recalls. And I just got overwhelmed. He went viral again during the president's first address to a joint session of Congress for waving at Speaker Nancy Pelosi and blowing kisses at his wife as the two women waited for Biden to enter. I look like Forrest Gump, he says. I'm just thinking, okay, nobody saw that. Everybody saw it. But if Emhoff draws attention for his bumbling exuberance, his tenure as second gentleman has been mostly free of verbal gaffes. Being a lawyer comes in handy, he says. I've been very cognizant of what comes out of my mouth. His facial expressions are a different story. When I ask what he misses about his old life, he crosses his eyes and smiles, as if to say a lot. If Emhoff's newness gives him an unfiltered view from inside the White House bubble, it is his maleness that makes history. All of his predecessors have been women, and usually women who were used to the political spotlight. Joe Biden had been through two presidential campaigns and spent decades as a Senate spouse by the time she became Second Lady. Karen Pence was First Lady of Indiana before she was Second Lady of the United States. When I asked Emhoff if he had heard from Mother Pence, as her husband reportedly refers to her, his eyes flashed. Mrs. Pence, he snapped, has been very gracious in giving advice. The role of second spouse traditionally involves historically feminized tasks like hosting luncheons and selecting china. To that end, Emhoff says he's learning about wallpaper. Some of those things are genderized, where, oh, a man can't pick wallpaper and pick china. Technically, in the reporting and flow charts, it all reports up to me, he says. But he adds, I'm married to Kamala Harris, and she's going to have some opinions on china and wallpaper. So Emhoff usually narrows selections down to a few choices and then lets his wife pick. I'm doing things that I probably would not have done, he says, because one, it's part of the job, and two, it helps her. Still, Imhoff seems thrilled to find moments of spontaneity where he can. After the visit to the scenic Elizabeth River Walk on his New Jersey trip, Imhoff comes across a gym class full of high schoolers doing yoga poses in their school uniforms. Having spent the day walking slowly where he's told and standing on pieces of blue tape for photo ops, he seems to sense an opportunity to finally have some fun. "Should I downward dog this thing or what?" he says. Then he joins the kids for a shaky tree pose as the cameras click. "I can't hold this forever." Later, I asked the kids what they thought of second gentleman Doug Imhoff. They responded with a near-unanimous chorus. "Who?" Here are some of the kids photographed beside Imhoff. All of them are wearing masks. He's wearing a black mask with the same outfit as in that introductory photo. They're wearing their school uniforms, black slacks and red shirts, and wearing red masks. And a person, another woman, is snapping a selfie with the whole group. She has long dark hair, and she's wearing a green dress and a plaid red, blue, yellow mask. The caption reads, "Snapping a selfie with Tammy Murphy, the First Lady of New Jersey, and high school students in Newark." Charlotte Alter wrote the article with reporting by Julia Zorthian. Time Off Reviews. This is Books, A User's Guide to Human Emotions by Belinda Luscombe. Why is it that people are quick to say they're jealous of someone but will not admit to being envious? What's the difference between shame and guilt? Is hopelessness the same as despair? These are the questions Brené Brown, the sociology professor turned best-selling author and leadership consultant, tries to answer in her new book, Atlas of the Heart, that came out November 30. Although these may seem like trivial taxonomic issues to some, Brown believes the ability to precisely name feelings is a crucial skill, especially in the days of division. If we want to find the way back to ourselves and one another, we need language, she writes, and the grounded confidence to tell both our stories and to be stewards of the stories we hear. In surveys taken by 7,000 people over 5 years, Brown and her team found that on an average, people can identify only 3 emotions as they are actually feeling them: happiness, sadness, and anger. For Brown, who made her name by illuminating the finer contours of humans' emotional landscape, this is not nearly enough. So she sets out to map 87 different emotions and experiences, pointing out the distinguishing features of each. The differences between guilt and shame, for example, as fans of Brown already know from her wildly popular TED Talks, her 5 previous number one bestsellers, her podcasts, and Netflix lecture, is that guilt tells people they did something bad, while shame tells people they are something bad. The difference between envy and jealousy is envy materializes when one wants something somebody else has. Looks, status, and wealth are the big trio. While jealousy is the feeling that a relationship's being threatened. Hopelessness is a fleeting fear that a task's too difficult, and despair's a feeling life's too difficult, and so on. As a potential cartographer for the human experience, Brown is a solid candidate. She's the Dr. Fauci of feelings. She can take complex subjects that require years of study and explain them in a comprehensible and reassuring way. But unlike America's most famous public health official, Brown is allowed to be vulnerable. Indeed, she insists on it. Atlas flicks at her personal biography as a source of exposition. She mentions in passing she came from a dysfunctional but high-performing family. She's a recovering alcoholic, a committed swimmer, and a perfectionist. This formula, very human subject plus rigorous research, has powered her work for 20 years. Atlas, sold to HBO Max as an unscripted series even before it was published, is her most reader-friendly book yet, but it may also be her thinnest. Examining 87 emotions in an easy-to-digest 300 pages is a tall order, and some readers will feel the stretch marks. A good portion of the book is oversized quotes, and there are some less than persuasive sections. Isn't bittersweet self-explanatory? What is irony doing in a list of emotions? The pleasure of reading Brown's previous work has been dawning self-recognition, as she carefully and diligently loosened the knobs that bound readers' hearts and hindered their ability to cope with their circumstances. This is more a book of quick hits, a reference guide to dip into when readers need a little reorientation. Brown's attempts to help people find their way to one another is laudable, but she has compiled an atlas when we need a GPS. Movies. Two Old Souls, One of Them Just a Kid. This is by Stephanie Zakharik. Movies about childless adults learning life lessons from children are pretty much a terrible idea, unless they're made by Mike Mills, who turned his reflections on his own upbringing into the marvelous 20th Century Women from 2016. In Come On, Come On, Joaquin Phoenix plays Johnny, a single New York City radio journalist who agrees to look after his nephew Woody, his nephew Jesse, Woody Norman, a Los Angeles kid, while his sister, Gabby Hoffman, tends to some emotionally complicated personal business. At first, Johnny has no idea what to do with Jesse, an exceptionally bright 9-year-old whose favorite bedtime game is to imagine himself as an orphan with a tragic backstory. But each learns to accommodate the moods of the other, making both of their worlds a little bigger and a lot better. Phoenix earns accolades for playing oddballs and troubled loners, but he's better than almost anyone else at playing regular guys bewildered by life. And both he and Norman are terrific here. You may go into Come On, Come On, thinking, that's two words, Come On, Come On, thinking you know exactly what it's going to be, but coming out you may see you also got a million little firefly flashes of feeling you were not expecting. And that right there is the Mike Mills touch. And also movies, also by Stephanie Zakharik, a big-time filmmaker revisits his Northern Ireland boyhood. Kenneth Branagh, B-R-A-N-A-G-H, who gave us both a gorgeous full-length Hamlet, 1996, and a bloated Murder on the Orient Express, 2017, is an all-caps filmmaker, generally preferring the grand dramatic gesture even when a subtler flourish would do. Accordingly, his semi-autobiographical Belfast, which takes place in that northern Irish city in 1969 at the onset of the Troubles, is both intimate and almost comically egotistical. Yet Branagh has poured so much love into it that you cannot be too hard on him. The movie's affectionate energy ultimately proves irresistible. Early in Belfast, we see adorably sweater-clad 9-year-old Buddy, newcomer Jude Hill, playing with other kids on his idyllic little street. Then an angry mob storms the block, smashing windows, setting fires, for no reason that would be apparent to a kid. The small, tidy house where Buddy lives with his mother, Catriona Balfe, and brother, Louis Makuski, his father, Jamie Doran, is working in England to support his family, returning home for periodic visits, remains unscathed. It is, we are told, only the Catholic houses that are the targets of the rioters' rage, and Buddy's family is Protestant. Still, his parents decry the violence, should they stay or should they go. If you are looking for cogent ideological analysis of fairly recent Irish history, you will not find it in Belfast. But as a portrait of one future auteur's late 1960s childhood, the movie is vivid and heartfelt. Balfe and Dornan are superb as young parents trying to figure out what is best for their family amid escalating political violence. And as Buddy's adored grandfather, Sharon Hines, might have been a salt-of-the-earth cliché, yet his lovelorn hound eyes keep the movie grounded. Belfast is all about the power of memory, and not even Branagh, a lauded, over-the-top filmmaker and a knight to boot, can escape its spell. The next two reviews are under the heading Television. They're written by J.B., but I don't know who J.B. is. When the Shrink is a Schmuck, Marty Markowitz has issues. His father's died, leaving him a textile business and a vast fortune. Alas, Marty, Will Ferrell, lacks the intestinal fortitude to tell his ex-girlfriend he won't bankroll her vacations, let alone lead a company. So his sister Phyllis, Catherine Hahn, doing the SNL coffee talk accent, sends him to a psychiatrist, Dr. Ike, Paul Rudd, who makes a quick diagnosis. You let people take advantage of you. Then Ike spends 3 decades doing just that, manipulating Marty into giving him a job, money, and residence at a Hamptons house where Ike, posing as the owner, throws lavish parties. It sounds far-fetched, but it really happened, as recounted in the podcast The Shrink Next Door, before being fictionalized in this star-packed series of the same name. Although Rudd gives depth to an 80s Gatsby, the tone, comedic but rarely funny, and pace feel off. After a sluggish start, later episodes skip over decades at a time, leaving too many blanks to fill in. Most unfortunate is how many of the conspicuously Jewish characters, from Marty the Nebbish to Ike the Shyster to Phyllis the Shrew, play into ugly stereotypes. And that review was on The Shrink Next Door, which is on Apple TV Plus. Now again from Television, Space Cowboy Rides Again. Cowboy Bebop is a mood, one of Japanese anime's most distinctive creations. The 1998 series is set in the year 2071 and follows a colorful crew of bounty hunters and a corgi as they pilot their spaceship, the Bebop, through the galaxy in search of fugitives. Creator Shinichiro Watanabe conjures a post-apocalyptic landscape of casinos and dive bars where refugees from Earth have colonized other planets, mixing cultures and clinging to pop cultural detritus. It is film noir, Blade Runner, jazz and westerns, a love letter to ramen, martial arts, and classic rock. This is the kind of immersive world that attracts fiercely protective, tantrum-prone fans. As news about Netflix's live-action remake trickled out, some protested that John Cho, C-H-O, at 49 was too old to play 27-year-old anti-hero Spike Siegel. Others griped Daniela Pineda did not look sexy enough as Faye Valentine, an animated character so curvaceous as to be structurally unsound. As it turns out, the casting is not the problem at all. Neither is the plot, a lightly serialized chronicle of the Bebop's intensifying conflicts with a powerful interplanetary crime syndicate. We learn about the heartbreak that made Spike the languid drifter he is. His crewmates, Fiery Faye and Jet Black, Mustafa Shakir, a former police detective, have painful backstories of their own. What is missing from this gratuitous adaptation is the atmosphere. Although it does have a certain pulpy, shoddy cheek visual style and benefits greatly from a jazzy, dynamic new score by original bebop composer Yoko Kanno, it cannot match the collage of aesthetics, vibes, and cultural references that made its predecessor, feel more like a dispatch from the future than an attempt to simulate it in the present. Showrunner Andre Nemec has said he aimed to mine the archetypal nature of the characters and dig out deeper histories. Maybe that explains the otherwise baffling decision to adapt a 25-minute cartoon into episodes of up to an hour. Sadly, it misses the core appeal of Bebop, which finds its deepest resonance in a richly textured surface. Cowboy Bebop hit Netflix November 19. Time off essay. A photo here of an elegant looking woman, blonde hair, straight, razor sharp. Her face is tilted upward. It's a pale face with some heavy rouge on the cheek. She's in profile here. A heavily sequined black dress. One hand with a diamond ring showing, and the background is black, so it's really elegant and subtle and almost sordid. The caption reads, a singular combination of old-school sound and a savvy approach to modern celebrity fix Adele in the pop firmament. Adele is spelled A-D-E-L-E. Andrew R. Chow writes, the everlasting appeal of Adele. 6 years is a lifetime in pop music, in the time since Adele's last release, streaming took over. TikTok became the world's hit laboratory, reggaeton moved to pop's global center, and Taylor Swift became a rapper-turned-indie-folk chanteuse. Then there's Adele, picking up right where Hello left off, still belting out earth-shaking ballads in the pouring rain. In October, the 33-year-old Brit returned from creative hibernation with Easy on Me, the first single off her fourth album, 30, arrived November 19. As the years pass, her anachronisms grow more pronounced. She's an album artist in an era of virality, opting for scarcity instead of constant output, leaning on instrumentation that was available to Frank Sinatra. Still, Easy on Me set a new high for Spotify streams in a single day and topped the Billboard Hot 100 for 2 weeks. How has Adele remained relevant while blatantly ignoring trends? Part of her success lies exactly in this rebellion, which endears her to those concerned with the disposability of today's pop. But to paint her solely as a savior of some outmoded definition of real music would be to ignore the ways she aligns perfectly with digital age celebrity. Adele is both a throwback torch singer and a modern marketing genius. And it is the nexus of the two that will ensure her longevity. Of course, Adele's appeal starts with her music. Her voice has been astonishingly powerful since she broke out with 2008's Chasing Pavements and has only improved since. Easy on Me shows an utter mastery from her raspy middle to airy glissandos near the top. Equally vital is her emotional acuity, her keen understanding of narrative arc and ability to turn broad, relatable themes like nostalgia and insecurity into epic personal dramas. Her songs channel, then resolve our own pain, rubbing both salt and aloe on our wounds. It is not surprising many have succeeded in mimicry. See the months-long chart performance of Olivia Rodrigo's Driver's License or A Star Is Born's Shallow. Adele fans like to wax poetic about her musical integrity and wholesome approach in the era of WAP, W-A-P. Those kinds of comments are not just racially coded, but also ignore a host of non-musical reasons for her dominance. The popularity of music has always been entwined with larger narratives, and Adele's a master of turning life into art, to come off alternately as unreachable and relatable, to respond winkingly to headlines in a way that creates more headlines. Her brand is consistent. Album covers are simple close-ups of her face, and titles reflect her age as if she were releasing sequels in a cinematic universe. She's uniformly hilarious and potty-mouthed in interviews, playing up her Britishness almost to the level of caricature. Her faux clumsiness is offset by high fashion and celebrity friendships. She writes songs about real people, revealing select details in interviews, which in turn send listeners back to the songs to hunt for lyrical Easter eggs. All this lending a mythic quality to the music itself. Adele is a constant in a world in flux. Suffice it to say, we have a pretty good idea of what to expect when 36 rolls around. The 100 Best Inventions of 2021. Every year, Time highlights inventions that are making the world better, smarter, and even a bit more fun. To assemble our 2021 list, we solicited nominations from Times editors and correspondents around the world, as well as through an online application process. We then evaluated each contender on a number of key factors, including originality, creativity, efficacy, ambition, and impact. The results a list that includes an innovative, eco-friendly dye for jeans, a truly novel pasta shape, groundbreaking vaccines for COVID-19 and malaria, and much more. The photographs are by Margot Walter for Time, and reporting is by Eloise Berry, Leslie Dickstein, Mariah Espada, Alejandro de la Garza, Nick Popley, Simone Shaw, and Julia Zorthian. I don't suppose I'll be able to read all of it, but here we go. Beauty, skincare on demand, Opulous Beauty Labs treatment system. Dr. Rob Ackridge, who invented the Clarisonic face cleaning brush 17 years ago, found inspiration for his latest beauty creation in a chocolate shop in Paris. Most of the chocolates were individual morsels, he says, and each created an experience that could only be achieved at the time you bit into them. Why couldn't skincare be the same, he wondered. Now it is. Think of the Opulous Beauty Labs treatment system, $395, that's $395, as a Nespresso machine for skincare, minus the plastic waste. Customers place a small paper pod, which includes two formulations, into the water bottle-sized device, which heats up to mix the formula and deliver a single-use dose of skincare product to be applied immediately when it's warm and more easily absorbed by the skin. Opulous currently offers a retinol treatment with a recent $8 million infusion of cash from investors. More treatments are on the way. Taylor Bryant wrote that column. Now, education, teaching kids to code. This is by Chad de Guzman. Sphero Indy. At its most basic level, coding is a matter of problem solving and pattern recognition. Sphero Indy teaches both, no screen required. Instead, kids as young as 4 use different colored silicon tiles to move a robotic car from point A to point B. Green tiles increasing its speed. Pink tiles telling it to turn 90 degrees left. Purple tiles telling it to spin and dance, and so on. We really wanted to take these abstract concepts and bring them into the physical world, says Jeff Wienkraut, one of the principal engineers who worked on the product. A student kit priced at $124.99 includes the car and 20 colored tiles to help kids make programming-based puzzles. This is just a chunky little blue car here, with black wheels and no headlights and nothing inside. It has a little black fake roof on it. And we see here the purple tiles where it's turning somewhere to go someplace. Design, comfy kicks for healthcare workers. Some shoes here. They look like sneakers, like my walking shoes. The small article is written by Jenna Caldwell. Clove, C-L-O-V-E, sneakers. The average healthcare worker spends more than 5 hours of the workday standing. The Clove sneaker, $129, created specifically for those who tend to patients, provides some much-needed foot therapy for doctors, nurses, and more. Thick EVA, ethylene vinyl acetate foam, midsoles offer an extra layer of comfort and stability. The shoes are wrapped in Japanese Clarino artificial leather, making them easy to clean and fluid resistant, so they are less susceptible to damage from exposure to hospital chemicals or bodily fluids that may deteriorate lesser sneakers. Thanks to high rebound, supportive, and machine washable insoles, the sneakers fight odors and prevent bacteria buildup too. Medical care, a public health breakthrough. Mosquirix malaria vaccine. Malaria has long been a global scourge, killing some 500,000 people a year, more than half of them children under five. But that may be about to change thanks to the introduction of a malaria vaccine, the first vaccine ever against a parasitic infection. The shot has been in the works since 1987 at a cost of more than $750 million, mostly funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and GlaxoSmithKline. Dubbed Mosquirix, M-O-S-Q-U-I-R-I-X, it was recommended for approval by the World Health Organization in October after a field trial involving 800,000 children in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi. The four-dose regimen was found to cut the risk of infection by 40% and the risk of severe infection by 30%. Jeffrey Kluger wrote about Mosquirix. Now, this copper-colored tumbler device is under the wellness column, a refined rinse, Quip, Q-U-I-P mouthwash. Amy Gunia writes, using mouthwash may not be as important as brushing and flossing, but a daily rinse can kill bacteria in your mouth, strengthen your teeth, and help prevent gum disease. Still, about 40% of Americans did not use mouthwash in 2020 because, perhaps, of the burn associated with it, though the look of the bulky plastic bottle on their bathroom sink probably did not help either. Quip, best known for its stylish electric toothbrushes, has launched a similarly sleek, refillable dispenser. It lives front and center in the bathroom to remind you to rinse every day, says Simon Enover, the company's co-founder and CEO. Filled with mouthwash formulated to avoid that nasty burning sensation. But the company is not just trying to encourage better oral hygiene. The product comes in a concentrated formula in 100% recyclable bottles that are much smaller than the average plastic mouthwash container. So it is better for the environment, not just for your mouth. Accessibility, the space-saving wheelchair. Revolve Air by Jesse Will. Former Ferrari designer Andrea Mochelin knows how to make things move fast. Now he's applying his skills to an even more gratifying project, building a better, more travel-friendly portable wheelchair. The Revolve Air's hexagonally structured, puncture-proof wheels fold up, allowing the chair to take up 60% less space than a standard folding wheelchair, so it fits in an airplane's overhead compartment. Mochelin's next speed challenge, getting the Revolve Air from 2,500 out by mid-2022 to the nearly 12,000 customers on his waiting list. Basically, they are telling me, do it as soon as possible because we need it, Mochelin says. Transportation, self-driving delivery, Nuro, N-U-R-O-R-2. This by Jeffrey Kluger. Someday in the near future, your pizza order might arrive at your door courtesy of a robot, specifically the R2 delivery system, an electric self-driving vehicle developed by San Francisco-based Nuro. About the size of a golf cart, the R2 is equipped with 360-degree cameras, short and long-range radar, and ultrasonic sensors, and is capable of speeds up to 25 miles per hour. The vehicle is designed to solve a long-time problem for shippers, last-mile delivery, that is, the point at which goods are brought from distribution centers to their ultimate destination, which tends to be the most logistically tricky, because individual items need to go to different addresses, which can involve a lot of trucks, drivers, and stops. Nuro has partnered with Domino's, FedEx, and Kroger in Houston to test the R2 in real-life traffic conditions. They're also on the road in Phoenix and Mountain View, California. The one pictured here looks like a little toy car. It has the Domino's logo on the side. It's white with black wheels, and it looks like it has black windshields front and back and some kind of a little satellite tower apparatus on its top. Award-winning television from entertainment. This is by Patrick Lucas Austin. LG C1. If you want to know what the best of the best of the best feels like, sit in front of an LG C1 for an hour. The 4K OLED television's display ditches LCD TV's traditional backlit design, opting instead for pixels that create their own light, resulting in gorgeous colors, crisp images, and striking contrasts, even in low-light scenes. The C1 series, for $1,099, also offers a high-speed 120Hz refresh rate and support for gamer-friendly features like AMD FreeSync and NVIDIA G-Sync, making it one of the best options for pairing with the new Xbox Series X or PlayStation 5 consoles. No wonder it was the year's best-selling premium TV. The C1 series even won a technical and engineering Emmy in January, as they are often used as reference monitors for movie production and optimization. Sustainability. Blue jeans go green. H-U-U-E, Hue, I suppose, by Aaron Baker. Jeans are a perennial fashion favorite, with more than 4.5 billion pairs sold every year. But their synthetic indigo dye takes a toll on the environment, contaminating water with toxic chemical runoff. Biotechnology company Hue has specifically engineered bacteria that turns natural sugars into indigo-identical dye without the environmental impact by mimicking how enzymes in plants create colors. In September, the company partnered with the cell programming platform Ginkgo Bioworks to scale up production and plans to start shipping to denim designers by the end of the year. Social Good, Help for the Hungry, Bento, B-E-N-T-O, by Guadalupe Gonzalez. When Mick Ebeling set out to tackle the food insecurity crisis that affects 1 in 8 Americans, he envisioned something useful and convenient that could also protect users' dignity. The answer? Cell phones. More specifically, a text messaging service called Bento that partners with local organizations and government agencies to enroll people in need of food assistance. Once signed up, users can text Hungry to a number associated with the service. They can then select a no-cost meal, that's no-cost meal, from nearby participating restaurants, which process bento orders as they would any other, allowing users to pick up their meals without drawing attention to their situation. Bento has provided 150,000 healthy meals since its launch in March 2020, Ebeling says. Weightlessness awaits. This is beneath the travel headline. New Shepherd. S-H-E-P-A-R-D. This is written by Jeffrey Kluger and features a photo of a rocket taking off from a big rocket tower. There are flames beneath it and very large lettering on the side, Blue Origin. October 13, actor William Shatner and three others boarded a rocket and were shot 62 miles into the sky to the edge of Earth's atmosphere, heralding a new era of commercial space tourism. Captain Kirk's vessel, the New Shepard rocket, a nimble 59-foot-tall booster and capsule designed and built by Blue Origin, the aerospace company founded by former Amazon boss Jeff Bezos. The rocket has so far carried two crews of space tourists on brief 11-minute hops to space. It uses clean-burning liquid oxygen and hydrogen fuel, and is entirely reusable, with the capsule portion descending by parachute and the booster portion returning to Earth under its own engine power and landing upright. Interested in blasting off yourself? Unfortunately, Blue Origin has not yet announced a price for the new Shepard tickets or a date when they will be publicly offered. The 911 Alternative, Subdial, under Apps and Software by Jason Cipriani. Americans know to call 911 when dealing with an emergency, but whom do you call when neither law enforcement nor paramedics are the right choice for the problem at hand? Griselda Viteri, finance manager at design firm Big Human, came up with a solution, Subdial, a free app offering direct access to resources that can help users with issues relating to mental health, domestic violence, hunger, and more. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.